true number. I'm not lying.
Wow.
I'm like, how is it? This is like, I don't know, a toothpick castle. Shopomaniacs, you're listening to another episode of the Shop Talk Show. I'm Dave Rupert. With me is Chris Coyer.
Hi. What is this, 310?
Yeah. 310. Almost to 311. Bow, ba, down.
Down. I suppose we should have, save that for the next one.
Yeah, we'll do a full.
I have friends that go on a 311 cruise, and they didn't just go on a 311 cruise once. It's like seven times they've been on. They just love it.
They party down with 311.
Yeah, and they told me about these. Like, you go on and you listen to 311, but there's other bands as well. But then they have this rave where you walk into this room and it's totally silent, and you have your choice of two headphones that you put on your head, and there's two DJs spinning up there, right? But they only get broadcast through the headphones, so there's no loudness. And because people in the room went 50-50 on which DJ they're listening to, people are dancing and grooving and stuff, but they, you're only listening to one or the other of them.
At like, so nobody's in sync speeds. Yeah. And yeah, oh, wicked.
Like, that is all right. So cool and weird.
Well, hey, Chris, it's May, hitting the middle of May, which for overweight men in Texas, that means an endless battle against humidity. Let's get the humidity watch.
I'm wearing a thick sweatshirt. 100%. It's going to get warm today, but I'm still scraping my windshield here in Bend, Oregon. So it's and I'm clinging on to my thick clothes because, again, as an overweight man, I really prefer sweaters to T-shirts. But
yeah, the cool actually is what complimentary to the physique.
I tried to get the Dave family, the Rupert family, to join me here in Bend. Instead, they got a new house in Austin. So
new house in Austin. Almost done with that. I'm gonna sell the old house. Oh my gosh! I'm
gonna wear a T-shirt, Chris, that says "Lost them to Austin."
Lost them to Austin. I rented a power washer. I know that's not what this show is about.
I own one, so I don't even have to rent one.
What?
Do with all the right story. Tell me, how satisfying was it?
So satisfying. I did not draw any body parts on my driveway, and I regret that, and I will apologize here on the show for not tweeting.
Regrettable,
pictures of that.
Yeah, indeed.
But it was quite a fun time. And man, those things just shred.
We just had a lot of like spider webs and bugs and crap when we lived by the lake in Milwaukee, and we just really needed it to keep the house clean.
Question. Okay, so I'm looking out my window right now, right out the window of my new house, and my neighbor has a little bit of mildew on his panels. How illegal is it for me to wash his house in the middle of the day?
I think the law is a little vague on power washing other people's things, you know,
because he doesn't see it. I see it out my window. So if I'm in my house shooting like power washing from the house, I didn't even step on his property. So.
You know what?
Give like
it a few weeks, watch his movements, see when he's coming and going from the house, and just schedule it at a time when he drives away.
Okay, he leaves, and then I just like drive by his house.
real quick. You can get this done between 8:18 and 8:27 in the morning.
Yeah, easily. There's like, I have like a tape deck, and it's like bang, ba-ding, da-ding, ba-ding, da-ding, ba-ding. Like some kind of heist spy music that turns on. So, yes.
Dave's hugging the wall. He's got camo on.
Camo on. Like, I've got, it's the middle of the morning, but I've got the night vision goggles. And I'm just closing down.
You put them on and it's so bright that you just rip them off.
I don't know what I'm shooting.
Ah! Yeah.
Oh, my God.
The first thing you do is break his window.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
All right. We turned into one of those podcasts where we just talk to each other in the beginning of the thing for a while. That's okay. I'd like to say in episode 307, it's 310 now, we put a very vague, it was like the, I don't know, what'd you title it? Like Existential Questions was the name of the.
You kind of shock and awed me with a, hey, why do we even do this anymore?
Which, you know, that'll just happen from time to time. We all have those moments. But the idea was, can you tell us, when did you start listening? Why do you listen? Like, what do you get out of that? All those kind of things. At some point, we'd like to do a more formal survey kind of thing. So stay tuned for that. But we gave you no, like, particular call to action. You're like, here's how we want you to get in touch with us. So y'all found a way. You emailed me, or you emailed in the show form, or used Twitter. All of those were acceptable and awesome, by the way. And a ton of you reached out and said, a lot of you said, I've been listening since episode 0. I've been listening since episode 300. So there's a wide range of when people started. And I think that's wonderful. And so many of you, it was so encouraging too. It was everyone that came in. It was some people wrote out their life story, or at least their professional life story. And it was fascinating to read. So if I didn't get back to you, sorry, I tried to get back to pretty much everyone who wrote in, at least with a thank you that says, and so if you didn't get one, consider this your thank you. Thank you so much for telling us about, you know, how you listen to the show and why you listen to the show and all that. So we can probably largely leave it at that, but it was wonderful to know how many of you are out there that care. And our brand is strong, I'd say.
Yeah. Yeah. I got called a curmudgeon, I think, which I'll take it.
That was as bad as it got. Yeah, maybe.
I'm old. I'll take it. But yeah, thanks everyone for writing in. That was actually very valuable. We may consult a professional and mm-hmm. maybe get some very good kind of data, because right now it's just kind of a collection of tweets.
They've actually told me that he's trying to hire Dan Rather to up his interviewing skills. There's a Patreon I'm going to start.
Yeah, no, I was like, how do I, this is very exciting. I'm excited to do podcasts. How am I going to do the next 300 more? I would love to get really good at interviewing and get really good at podcasting without saying all the time. So how do I do that? And I don't know. And I'm like, is there a night school for broadcasters that I can go to? Can I get a?
I'll take it with you. You know, because to some degree, we're better than when we started. For sure, we've gotten more comfortable with each other's dynamics. I still talk too much and cut you off too much, but we're certainly have a better repertoire and vibe than we did in the beginning. So you do get a little bit better with experience, but I think there's a cap to that, and it's a little slow in that. And then we're just not we're very amateur in this world.
I watch clips of CNN, all the, they come on the Twitter feeds or whatever. And, Don Lemon or somebody, he'll be like, if anyone wants to call in about this subject, call in right now. I will talk to you. And I'm just like, No, Don, because you won't know how to talk to that person, but if you're a good interviewer, broadcaster, you're so comfortable doing it. And so I would like to get better. So I'm just kind of looking for ways to do this, and how do we do the next kind of 300 more, and what does that look like? So very cool. Thanks for all the feedback. Really appreciate it.
Yep, absolutely. So we have this show and the next show, I think we're going to, and maybe even the couple after that, are going to be Q&A type of shows, which are some of our favorite to do based on your feedback. So we're going to get into a bunch of questions, but stay tuned. We're still going to have guests and topic-based shows. Those are some of our favorites to do anyway. So the format will remain varied here on Chop Duck Show, but in the summer, as we often do, we kind of, because of scheduling, just the summer's busy, darn it. We get into more Q&A style shows. So stay tuned for that. I'd like to say this is one interesting thing, more Gutenberg feedback. I know we've brought it up a number of times, but I've been watching this. And in fact, I spun up a new WordPress site, not entirely rare in my life, but I decided that this is insane, I realize it's going to sound, but I've decided to blog a little bit, literally about email, because I feel I can't get it out in my head. I think about email all the time. So this, I don't know, it's not going to knock anybody's socks off probably, but I think I'm going to slowly build up my writing archive of the things that go through my head in relationship to email. And this is not about HTML email or the technology of email. It's more about the productivity of email and how email fits into our lives. And I like email. I feel like I'm one of the few, but I feel like one of my goals is to convince people that email is good. So the email, the domain name in the Chris Coyer style is email-is-good.com. Email is good with dashes in it. And so I spin it up and I'm like, you know what? This is the future of WordPress, so I might as well just activate Gutenberg right away as a plugin and just pick a default theme and just get to blog. And of course, it took me like 2 hours tops to like have a WordPress setup that's perfectly to my liking. And so far, I'm very much enjoying using the Gutenberg on kind of a production site action, which is cool. But Morgan Baker wrote in to say that one of the things that they have trouble with sometimes in WordPress land is this idea that when you're building a site for a client and the idea is to hand it off to that client, that Gutenberg is going to work well for them because of the concept of blocks in there. Like it suits client work better than anything else, because it's like clients want this idea of like, put this block here and this block here and this gallery here. And he's been like fitting those together with short codes and advanced custom fields and form builder or just builder style page builder plugins. And it's been a mess. He's like, I wonder if Gutenberg like was going to stop all of that. And like, I can just hand my site to a client with all these custom blocks in there, and that's good enough alone. I think they might be right. I think that's a cool take on it, which also means that as WordPress like theme developers, I think more WordPress theme developers are going to be getting into block development in a surprising amount. I think there's plenty of theme developers that just don't do plugins at all, WordPress plugins. They're just like, I don't know, I just make themes. I design the theme part of it, but I don't get too much into like building custom plugins. I think there's going to be more people being like, you know what, I am going to get into building blocks though, because that's what my clients need. Anyway.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's all. I do, like, instead of you're handing over these kind of like really cobbled together templates and these really, you know, kind of giant plugins that have like fees for the pro features. In theory, you can just hand over just a few Gutenberg plugins and build out a page. That's kind of cool. Yeah. Hey, beep, 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 beep. We got some breaking news, Chris.
Yeah.
We got some information back on the scam. If you remember a couple episodes
ago. I do remember the scam. The scam was, the setup was something like, I don't know, like, I want to work with you. I want to pay you a bunch of money to design a website for me. What's your quote? You know, I need a 3-page website with, and then you're like, this feels like a scam, but I'm not sure why.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so a lot of people wrote in and kind of explained the scam. And here's how it kind of works. It goes,
well, including like, the original person wrote in and said, I actually like followed through with the scam. I wasn't scammed, but so there, yeah, explain it. But we know exactly how it works now.
Yeah. Okay. So the original email was, hey, please make an 8-page, very simple e-commerce site, 8 templates. That's all I need. And you're like, that doesn't sound right. And it's $10,000 or $8,000 or something. It's pretty decent money. I mean, that's not chump change. And they make it sound so easy. But the scam is how's it work? So they say like, okay, you have I will pay you, but the designer needs to be paid and I'll like reimburse you, right? And then they basically run a card and then they cancel the check or whatever. So yeah, basically
I don't even know if this is always a check, although that could be, but they might even like literally send you some money to your bank account from mm-hmm. a thing, but it's done in such a way that they know they can reverse it. So even if you check your bank account and you're like, oh, they really did send me this money, I'm going to now send some money to this other designer. Then all of a sudden you get a charge back. The money's gone. Yeah. And you're out the money that you forwarded the designer or whatever. Like, whoa, what a.
Yeah. So you end up paying the designer like $3,000. And then all of a sudden that $3,000 or $3,800 or whatever that they gave you disappears from your account. So this is pretty bogus practice. I mean, I've had clients do similar things. It's just not good. And then it's like such a low amount. You usually can't even do like small claims court, and they're probably not even in the US or whatever. But
I have no idea.
So that's kind of the scam, is basically they they say like, oh, you need to pay the designer for me and then I'll pay you back. And then
the idea is that they have this fraudulent card to work with. Like, haven't you heard these things where like you buy 100 credit cards from in these are like validated working credit cards from some black market site. You pay $1,000 and they'll give you 100 working credit cards. And it's, you know, they're expensive to buy, but that, you know, that they work and they're like, so a bunch of credit cards get stolen, let's say 10,000 of them. Then they find some service out there on the internet, something like CodePen, although we don't worry, we're not used for this way, but I've dealt with this throughout my career. They'll find some really inexpensive plan, the cheapest thing they can buy, and they'll run all 10,000 credit cards through this web service to see which ones go through and which ones don't. If it goes through, that's good. That credit card works and it's sellable. You can sell it to some other bad person, you know, then they're the one, like, your criminal expertise is getting these credit cards. Somebody else's criminal expertise is using the credit card to get money out of it. They're kind of like different criminal skill sets. And so, but by the time you've charged it once, that weird thing's going to show up on that credit card. And now the clock is ticking for that person to find out that their credit card has been compromised and cancel the card. So you got to use it quickly. So you sell it to somebody else. They use it quickly. For example, in this scam to send somebody $3,800, it works. But the clock has already started ticking on that credit card. Like, that's there's going to be a chargeback. And as a matter of fact, they don't care if there's ever a chargeback or not. They got you to give money to somebody else. So
yeah, it was never their card.
Well, theoretically, you could do a chargeback on that other money. But, like, can you? Will you? Will your bank accept that? I don't know. I don't think you as a person have as much control to do a chargeback. You know, you can't pay somebody and pay your mortgage and then call the bank and be like, ah, wait, I want my mortgage money back. It just, you don't have as much control that way.
Yeah, here's an excerpt from the actual email back from the scammer. I would have sent the money myself, but I'm on a business trip right now. And for the progress of my business, I need the site ready before I get back. I'm cashless. I only got my credit card here. So you'll be charging my credit card for the remainder of the balance. So, yeah. So basically you charge the card and then it doesn't exist anymore. So,
but meanwhile, hey, I can see a somewhat reasonable person being like, all right, I'm going to try to charge the card. Oh, it worked. I got the money. Ah, cool.
Yeah.
You know, like, I guess we'll proceed with this project. All of a sudden the money disappears from your account.
Yeah, you don't find out till like 3 months from now or like a month from now. You're like, oh, hey, I used to have like $3,000 in my account and now it's gone. So careful out there. If it sounds like a scam, it probably is a scam.
Yeah, so. Absolutely. And thanks for everybody who wrote in explaining the scam. I'd say there's a lot of people that wrote in speculating how it works and most of you got it right.
Mm-hmm. So, we got pretty close. We weren't exactly right, though.
No, but the important part is it's a scam. Definitely don't do it.
Mm-hmm. All right. Let's get in the meat and potatoes of the Chop Talk Show. First question is from Tim Doppenberg. Tech docs, why are they so ugly? The documentation has no formatting, no sentences. And so sentences completely span my 29-inch monitor, making it impossible for me to properly read. In the end, I had to make my own style sheet using a browser extension after setting a max width, the legible font family size, and adding some line height and to the docs to become readable. Whoa.
So, you know, and it's just a general complaint about tech docs, he's saying, but it could be any website really. And I would side eye GitLab a little bit. I like the GitLab team and the people and everybody seems so nice and excited. And I love GitLab as a product, but that's one of my issues with it. Like, we use the issue tracker so much and it has that thing where it's kind of an unlimited line length thing. I feel like the typography needs a good look on the thing and how images and stuff are handled. It's one of those, like, I can't read line length this line. So it's to the point where I have my own kind of custom theme for it through a browser extension that we'll just take control over this thing. But okay, so Tim Doppenberg's, like, why do they have to be so bad? I often think of, like, API documentation. Like, that's an opportunity to not do a bad job.
Yeah, you know, I'm going to apply a little bit of empathy to the situation.
Sure.
because code examples need to be kind of long, 80 to 100 characters, you know, mm-hmm. like that's like the sweet spot for wrapping code, or 80 to 120, I'd say. I think in our brains, you know, developer, especially developer documentation, is used to kind of these long bits of text, but it's awful for reading paragraphs. And so this happens even in print. I don't know if you remember the old Prag Prog books, kind of big in the Ruby scene.
Pragmatic Ruby or Pragmatic, Rails one was so popular. I remember.
Yeah. So like Prag Prog, they had like 120 character, like line lengths in their kind of, you know, books to kind of match the code size, the code blocks. And way too long. And even I have a book right here. I'm going to show you. It's right here. It's a book called Game Feel. And it's about look at that. That's so, I'm showing Chris on the video.
That is a tech book like plague, isn't it? The too long.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's just way too long and it's really difficult. So I would say this happens kind of everywhere. I think it's just, probably developers stuff written by developers, you know, even Stack Overflow gets a little long, right?
Isn't there like P comma LI comma DD comma, I don't know, pick the major ones and then just go max with like
40M
40 CH. You could use character units. I don't know. That way the container can be wide. You're not relying on the containers width for the line length. You're saying we have a readable textual things should have a max width. And then that won't affect your code. Your code is just as wide as it needs to be.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I wish it was a lot easier. I mean, you can always kind of hop into Web Inspector and do that, you know?
Yeah, that's why which one do I use? I'm trying, is it StyleBot? Let me try to, it's StyleBot, which is the one that's totally, it's not deprecated, it's just nobody works on it, you can tell, for years and years, but it has the cleanest little, like, can you please just apply this CSS to this URL every time I hit it? Mm-hmm. I think that I use it pretty regularly. Like, oh, this site has that obnoxious thing. I'm just going to write one little line of CSS quick, so I'll never think about it again. It works for me pretty well. I should say I thought, you know, there's so many good examples. I find myself in the React docs a lot, and I'm like, these are nice. These are nice looking docs. I'd also say, like, if your docs suck, can you just bootstrap it? That's what Bootstrap's for. Just like, what does the foundation default style sheet do to your docs? Like, if you rip out your CSS and just drop in foundation.css, is it improvement? Yes. Ship it.
Yeah.
I also want to bring up a few other things. I read this article on Medium the other day. It was the Alexei Kunsatov. Oh, man, look at your API was the title of the post. And there was some examples of docs in there there's some frameworks for API docs that are great. And it reminded me, I'm like, oh, this is why that company's API docs are so sweet, is because they've used this. So one of them is called Postman. So check out getpostman.com. And it's like not just docs, but I think it helps you build your API in general, but the docs is kind of a big thing that it does. And so if you look up like the Airtable docs, like Airtable is a pretty cool software, and look at the API docs for them, you're like, this is amazing. It's not only like really clear like what all the API endpoints are, but if you're logged in, it like uses, and you're looking at like the API docs, you were like previously looking at your data in Airtable, then you go to the doc, it'll show you like your, like, what does a curl call look like on your data? And it shows you a response with your data in the response. And it just feels so like, oh, wow. Yeah. You know, like, this is really clearly showing me. This isn't a demo. This is like actually using the API to show me what the API does. How awesome is that?
No, there's so much like, you go to different developer documentation and it's almost like that first screen, you know, can you use it Do you think you know how to use it based on the first screen of text, you know, or the README or whatever in a GitHub project?
Yeah.
You know, like, do you feel like you can use it just using that? There's a lot of stuff I don't feel like I can use, you know, like it says, oh, just do this and you do it and you're just, nope, I don't get it. But, you know, I like it when that first screen, you can like tell what you need to do.
I like that. Yeah. Yeah. That you should, even if it's not like, and like jQuery plugins used to be great at this, you know, it's just like, what's the API? What's all the params I can send to the API? And you'd see that and you'd be like, oh, I get it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's what I mean. Control.
What was it that came up in Scikit? What was it? Was the one about machine learning or something like that? It was like setting up like machine learning stuff, or was it PySci or Sci Toolkit? I want to say it was, but anyway, like you have to click around quite a bit before you even like get to like a here's how to use it, you know. So anyway, it just kind of makes a difference to me, at least, like how like, you know, legible something is to use. So anyway.
So this article, this, oh man, look at your API, clued me into some other products out there that are kind of for this, that I think help with your API to some degree, but also help document it and control it. Another one was swagger.io, and another one was Oracle's Apiary. And I'm like, wow, these things have come a long way. This is really kind of quite cool. I think Amazon has some API products that help too. Not probably with the UI, because Amazon never gives you good API.
UI. I would love like a CSS trick post on, maybe you're writing this as we speak, but on how to write good docs. I mean, it would just be because I have, you know, plenty of dumb little open source repos, and I get a lot of the similar questions every time, and I'm just like, it's in the docs. Did you not read the docs? Did I mess up the docs? Now I'm wondering, you know, or like, you know, for jQuery, but I'm thinking of my little jQuery plugins mostly, but like, you know, like a table of like the options, you know, I don't do that. But that's like, that's the first thing I look for when I go use another plugin, you know, or something.
Yeah.
Are the options?
Get that juiciest code snippet towards the top if you can.
Yeah. The hello world at the
top.
But
I don't really make a tech product like that. You know, like, we have, like, I don't know. My experience mostly with docs is the CodePen docs, which is definitely like a long-term work in progress. You know, a lot of it was, at first, it's just like, I don't know, take a crack at it, do the best you can. And then it evolves over time, and you really need to be like, oh, is this actually an FAQ in support? Then it needs to have a docs page, because all of a sudden it makes answering that question a lot easier. You just send them to the docs. And once it's in the docs, you'll probably get less emails about it anyway, because believe it or not, nerds actually do read docs for the most part. We made a change to our documentation recently that I think is kind of neat. I don't know, you know, these things tend to change. So if you're listening to this 2 years from now, like, I don't know that it'll be exactly the same or not. But Algolia, and this is not a sponsored spot, although I'd love to have Algolia as a sponsor. Are you That's listening?
My favorite country. No.
That was good.
It's Algolia. Solid. I don't know.
Have you never used, or are you asking me to softball it to me?
I do not know. I'm for some reason, my wires have crossed into my brain, and now the Udemy guy from YouTube is up on my, have you heard about Algolia? Millions of
it's
experts.
It's a great product. Okay, it's kind of okay, like spinning, you know, like, have you heard of Solr?
Okay. Yeah. Search.
And yeah, you got to tokenize all your credits. And Solr is a great thing too. And it's part of a search stack that you would use on a large scale app to build your own search, because you can't rely on Google search or whatever. You need your own high powered, really good search. You're going to build it. Solr is going to be a part of that. And that's what we do at CodePen. We have our, a hand rolled thing. I think back in time, you know, like in another world, or possibly like you know, today we might consider using something like Algolia instead, which is a paid product, but it kind of simplifies the crap out of your search. You still send all, you still have all this data that you need to, you know, house on your side, but you just send it all to Algolia and they give you search APIs basically for your own data. And it's incredibly fast and it's, it has all kinds of incredible intelligence built into it. It's kind of like a product for search. You build your search on top of their kind of platform, and it, and what it gives you is really worth it, and it's not particularly expensive, so it's cool. So anyway, I brought it up because of Docs. Is not only do they have that product, but they have a few other products. One of them is kind of a free community project that basically helps with documentation search. So so we heard from them and they're like, check out how this works. And they spun up a little example of it in the CodePen docs. And it turns your input search field that you can visually see. And you can see this if you go to the CodePen documentation. And I put the, I put our search bar like front and center on these pages because now our search is so good. I want people to use it. As you type, it's got the fuzzy search thing going on. So if I type in like asset hosting or whatever, instantly you get a drop down that's stuff related to hosting. And not only does it search like titles and content, but it gives extra weight to like the header elements in the documentation, because oftentimes documentation has is a one long page that has lots of subsections to it. So it gives weight to like the H2s and H3s and H4s and stuff on that page and highlights those for you. And so the search results are great. It's just it's a search product that's built for documentation.
I just went to algolia.com/product to, and they have a little demo where you search for movies or whatever, and it has like mistypo tolerance. Like I typed in Jewamp like for a messed up jump, and I'm getting like 22 Jump Street, 21 Jump Street, Jumper, White Men Can't Jump. Like that's actually kind of hard to code. That's hard to code. So yeah, that's interesting. And it's pretty fast. It seems pretty fast. So
smoking fast. So yeah, like, I don't know. We just mentioned Docs. If you have Docs and want to build in a little Algolia search thing to that, that's a pretty doable thing. It increases the quality of your Docs quite a bit. This episode of Shop Talk Show is brought to you by Pork Bun, where you can get website domain names for your business or personal brand with the lowest prices and amazing free services. So here's one they sell. This is about the best deal you can get on a domain name. .design, literally, like, so it's not .com or .net or the normal ones. You know, there's lots of TLDs these days, top level domains. .design is one of them, and lots of people use them. You know, there's Facebook.design, Uber.design, NPR.design, so many of them, Airbnb.design. You can get one for literally free, so that's a pretty good deal. And it's not just like free just for the thing and they hook you into it. You get the email address, you get an SSL certificate, you get the whole nine yards for free. Go to porkbun.com, use the coupon code SHOPTALK and check out to get your free .design domain name. It's just so cool. You know, for there really is a problem with not that many great .coms left. If you really need a .com, you got to go weird with it and whatnot. But it's so great that there's so many of these TLDs that have opened up, so this land grab crap is over. .design is a great one. I'm a big fan of having one, CodePen.io, for example. Forget the .com, you know? Get a cool TLD. Google doesn't care, you know? I don't know. I just think it's great. Go to porkbun.com, get a absolutely free .design one by using coupon code SHOPTALK at checkout. Fantastic.
Next question. Brandon Benefield writes in, been learning heavily from lots of online learning resources for 5 months. Things are starting to click. Do you think it's too early to start applying for jobs?
No,
get a job. It's actually better to learn while working. I mean, yeah, don't do, because if you, spoiler alert, you're never done learning.
So I think the original question was longer. Sometimes we truncate these. Okay. And Ben Brandon was like, am I like dishonoring the profession in some way by jumping in too early or something? I'm like, I don't, nothing is that holy in this industry. If you can get a job, you get yourself a job.
No, I had a job. I mean, I did websites as a hobby for years, almost a decade. And then I got a job, and then I was making flash websites with my coworker Reagan. And it was like while I was making these like flash websites, which is It's fun, but it's really just animated pictures. Like, you just put a picture up there and then you animate it, and then you like you figured out how to put a form control in there. It's weird. But while I was reading that, I read Jeffrey Zeldman's book, and then I was just like, oh, we have to change everything and do like a, we have to, you know, make a fully HTML website. And it was a little bit like, people were like, what? And this is even 2006, but it worked out and it was good. And I think it paved the way kind of for the future. But I think you're always learning on the job. And, you know, I think you should keep learning, but also get paid to learn. So be honest, though, about your juniorness. I mean, you've only been doing it for 5 months. So,
right.
But just get in there and just say, hey, I'm
looking. Yeah, then work hard and learn more stuff. And if they regret it, then... Well, I mean, worst case scenario, you're back to the drawing board a little bit. But yeah, it's not going to happen to you. Don't worry about it. Just get
your job. Maybe it's, you know, I mean, maybe you do a website or something for somebody you know. That's something you can do. I think all of us probably, everyone I know started by making a website for their crappy band. So I think that's what you should do. You just make, make stuff. Just build websites.
Then you have a deeper portfolio and increases your chance of getting a job at all. But I'll tell you, you know, you apply, you got your 5 months of experience. You might as well see if you can get some interviews and stuff. You bomb the interview again. Who cares? It's not like then learn some more and apply again in 6 months. It's not like they're going to look at the email and be like, oh, this Brandon Benefield fella, he didn't pass our interviews 6 months ago. We're not going to give him a shot again. They're not even going to remember.
It's probably a new hiring manager too. So. Yeah. All of that turnover happens a lot. But yeah, no, you know, there's also other, you know, it's not like you're applying for a job for life either. You know, you can change the company. You can even just be like, hey, let's try a 3 month thing or something, you know, like sure. An audition period or something. And then it's, you know, that's good for you.
Because your first week on the job, you're going to learn so much. I remember, you know, God, my God, your onboarding is like, oh, we use, you know, this version control in this way. And this is how we talk to each other. And these are the tools we use. And this is what our code base is like. Your mind's going to explode with like, holy crap, that's how you do things. Every time I've experienced to step into some company and see what their work world is like, it expands my world just poof. And that's just seeing it, let alone being responsible for some parts in there and having to close some tickets or do some work. Oh, man, you're going to level up so fast. So get that job as soon as you can. Anonymous writes in, do you work with print at all? We do. And sometimes our clients and coworkers question the website colors, like they don't look quite right compared to the printed material. I simply explain why that is. But I'd like to hear your thoughts on that, and that's that, you know. So it's tricky. I mean,
Pantone 2 web problem.
Yeah, you hold up the brochure to the website and expect it to be exactly the same. I mean, you could tweak things around so that in that one exact scenario at that time, they happen to match. But I mean, come on, get out your phone, have them get out their phone, have everybody bring it up and set them right next to each other. Screens are just different. They're calibrated a bit differently. There's just no way, there's no technology that exists that allows you to be like, oh, I see you're on a, you know, a Surface Pro under these conditions, so I'm going to alter the hex code of this color to make sure it's at 87% brightness. I'll alter my hex code to be a little lighter so it matches the brochure. Just ain't going to happen.
No, different, you know, different. Well, thankfully, now I think all operating systems are in the same gamma, right? I think, is it 2.2 or 1.8? It's one of those. They're all using the same gamma, but it used to be like Windows and Macs had different gammas. And so that affects your color depth like extremely. And then even different browsers have different things. And this happens in game engines and stuff like that too. Like the Xbox only has 250 colors, not 256. So the colors are always off. So it just kind of rounds to the nearest, you know, hex, which seems like a total crime, but you know, they get to squeeze out, you know, whatever that much performance by calculating that less number of colors, you know? writing that to the graphics card. And so like there's even been like situations in the past where we had Chrome and Safari next to each other and like different orange entirely, different reds, different oranges, like even two browsers next to each other will not look the same sometimes.
And yeah. It's aggravating. It's a little unfortunate because you like there is technology involved for color management. It's just that on the web, there's, you know, and having an unlimited number of browser platform versions looking at your thing. And it's not just browser platform versions, the OS and the monitor and the setting. I mean, it's just, yeah. It's just impossible. I met a fellow here in Bend, Oregon once whose job was kind of color calibration in its relation to photography mostly, and really getting things super, super duper perfect, like in the digital document because of, I don't know what. It was so over my head. Anytime he talked about it, I was like, this isn't great. He basically got a specialized degree in it. One is like apparently few people in the world doing this kind of specialized work, but it didn't really have much to do with the web. I kind of glazed over because I'm like, oh, we don't have that kind of control. It's just, it ain't going to happen.
Well, and then when from print to web, you know, a lot of print is done in, what is it, CMYK, and a lot of, and web is only RGB. Mm-hmm. So you have to use that Adobe sRGB color profile to kind of make it even close to the web. And then does your monitor, is it 98% Adobe sRGB? Is it 100%, you know, color profile? And then, or do you have high dynamic range on your display? Yeah. Do you have the,
do you think little, there's some, you know how you in the past, Dave, you've said like the canonical like thing that you should test performance against is like an Android phone on 3G or something. You had some mm-hmm. like, this is like, this could be like a pretty good base level thing. Is I wonder if there's some version of that that's like, well, just get it right on like an Acer 780 or whatever on full brightness, and then that's the canonical color zone, and then everybody else can fall in line from there.
There kind of is, if you think about it. You know, a lot of people have your phone, your mobile phone, and what do immediately to like save battery? You power down the brightness, right? And so if you take a phone and put it at low brightness, can you read your website? What does it look like? That's kind of the test. I mean, like if you want your like worst case scenario, it's like, does it look okay-ish at like zero brightness? And probably your blue, you know, brand blue is probably not going to look right. So you just kind of have to accept, like, it's not so much like the web is at fault here. It's just devices, like computers, how people use computers is just so different. You know, not all hardware is created equal. So unless you have like a fully color calibrated, you know, like probably $5,000-$10,000 monitor, it's probably just not going to look exactly right. Womp womp. Sorry. But anyway, hopefully that comes.
And it was an anonymous user that wrote in for a while. I think that's absolutely fine. If you have a question and you just like don't want your name attached to it, I don't think it harms the show at all to write it anonymously. It's kind of fun to hear your name perhaps or know for sure that it was your question. So if you don't mind us reading your name, feel free to put your name with your question. Yeah. But if you don't want us to, anonymous is totally fine. So what do we got next, Dave?
Charlie Meisner writes in, and this is maybe getting into FAQ territory. How do you keep your API keys secret? It seems more secure to access API keys on the server, but for many front-end APIs, this can be clumsy. There's also, are there any simple tools that allow you to develop and deploy with API keys while also keeping them hidden from GitHub, Bitbucket, etc.? For some reason, APIs, this isn't a huge deal, but if the wrong person got a hold of the payment keys, well, that could be a disaster. Any tips and tricks?
There's definitely two things going on here. One of them is don't put your API keys in front-end code. And that this comes up in my life recently because I've been giving talks about all this serverless stuff that, you know, there's a lot of stuff we can do on the client, right? We could pull data from some data source, but you need an API key to do it. So, how important is that API key? Can you put it in client-side JavaScript and that's okay? That would be rare. Probably you have some server-side, and what's the right word for that? Like a middleman, or there's some word for
middleware.
That.
Middleware.
Like a really, just a simple function that all it does is like you AJAX to it, and it does a curl and with your protected API, gets the stuff, comes back to that function, comes back to you. It feels like a little bit hop, skip, and jumpy, but performance-wise, it's generally pretty much fine.
You could even lock down that little serverless function or whatever, or a server, you know. Yeah. You could lock that down to be like, only accept calls from localhost and this URL.
Sure, you could. But then the question is, this is still complicated because isn't the code for that serverless function or whatever, or if it's just a PHP function, or I don't know, who knows, isn't the code for that on GitHub? So all of a sudden my APIs are in my GitHub repo? Well, maybe it's just a private repo, so it doesn't matter. But what is the official, and I don't know the answer to this, what is the official strategy for my repo needs very secret keys and I don't want them anywhere near GitHub, period, private repo or not?
You need some environment variables, which is kind of like a Linux-y thing. But basically, you can set an environment variable. And then in Node, I'm thinking of Node, you just say like process.env.myvariable, my secret API key is. And then so you set it either on the server. Heroku has like
so you admin SSH in set. And you add it to a file that exists on the server, and it just sits there in like a flat file. But no, it's not in a repo. It's just. Yeah,
it can be like in a flat file. There's a cool little, this is something I love because I just think it's so intuitive. There's a .env, which has a Node version and it used to be like, originally was like a Ruby thing. But basically you say require .env, and that's the library, and then you add like a .config method and you have it. And so that'll like put all the, and then you create a .env file on your server. You never commit it in your GitHub repo because you never want to commit keys, right? And hand those around. You like kind of just secret pass those around, I guess. I don't know where you pass those around, but then you get that on the server, you get a .env file on the server, and then you can basically just use these like environment variables to, you know, connect to the database or connect to the.
So if you have your own server, password. That's going to work great. I don't know what the serverless story is there because you can't like SSH into a serverless environment to do that. Mm-hmm. So hopefully, like, you don't need to because it's kind of already private land. But I don't know, because sometimes, like, for example, I know Microsoft Azure has Cloud Functions, and you can, the Microsoft Azure website has a little editor in it, so you can just go edit code right in the browser. It's not like the world's greatest experience, but whatever. And so if you're like, I don't want to use their editor, I would rather have all my serverless functions be in a repo, then you can just point it at a repo and it will pull your, you know, just kind of like how Netlify works. You know, you push to a branch and it just sucks it up and it becomes production or whatever. This Azure functions can do it the same way. You push to that branch and those functions just update themselves and become production. But now you have this repo that's got your friggin' API keys in again. So is it okay because it's a private repo, or can you do something else? That maybe there's a story for it, you know, like they have some known way to handle this situation. I don't.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's probably an admin UI in that one of those Azure panels that I don't like so much, but then you just like input like the variable name, the username, the password.
Yeah. There's some UI, you know, for it.
You basically like write out what, here's what it should be named, and then you're gonna in your function call process.env.
I know Webtask has this as well. They have a story for your API keys right in the Webtask UI. Put your API keys in there, which is pretty cool.
So I think that's,
or you could run your own GitLab instance, and then it's a Git repo, but it's yours, so who cares?
So I think that's the best way. Never put them on the client, obviously. I mean, it's tough because like JavaScript on the server and JavaScript on the client, I think like sometimes you get mixed up on what's going where or whatever, especially with like universal JavaScript. And it's pretty easy, you know, like you're just like, I just want to code out a demo. Okay, I'll write my API key, fetch from the front end, you know, from the client and get data back. But then you're like, oh, in real life, I should never do that. Like, so that's, it's tough. I was going to say, there's another way that's kind of popular, but it depends on the service. Firebase has a dot well-known directory thing where you basically, it's just like Let's Encrypt. You like just basically upload a file to a directory and prove that you kind of own this domain. And you basically like send up like a keys directory or something, so your code never accesses that, but like Firebase like knows about it, and so Firebase is like, okay, this server where this code is okay, I can allow calls from this. So maybe cool. I'm not saying just use them, but you can look at how they're kind of doing it. And it's pretty nice. I would recommend it. So
there are ways, man. There are ways. This episode of Shop Talk Show is brought to you in part by DigitalOcean, old D-O. And in fact, the URL you want to go to is do.co, which is the most awesome URL ever. do.co/shoptalk to get $100 in infrastructure credit. Very generous of them. DigitalOcean is probably one of the most beloved web hosts out there. It's the easiest cloud platform to deploy, manage, and scale applications of any size. They have this like concept of droplets, perhaps you've seen, that are like, they're kind of like SSD-backed virtual machines that you deploy and are totally scalable, and you can put whatever the heck you want on there. And they also have this concept of spaces where it's just like storage of any kind. It's really, you can just do anything on Dio, and it's just so nice doing it. So easily deploy and scale your web app in seconds. You know, DigitalOcean removes cloud infrastructure friction so developers and their teams experience simplicity at scale. And again, it's $100. If you go to do.co/shoptalk, you know, there's hundreds of in-depth tutorials and an active community providing all kinds of support for you too if you have any questions about how this any of this stuff works. So thanks for your support, DigitalOcean. Ed Bummings writes in, why am I constantly installing packages over and over for projects I'm working on? I understand the -G flag for global install, but I can't exactly wrap that into my package.json if it's not explicitly downloaded and duct taped to my particular project. So we're talking about the world of npm here. If you're you're not, so he's like, I don't know. I got five, for example, Vue projects. Why do I gotta friggin' install Vue on all five of them? Can't I just be like npm install Vue -G and then I'm good to go? Okay, so Ed says, for example, every time I start a new project, I roll out my go-to, my standard package.json, include a few dev dependencies. You know, he likes Node SAS, some kind of server to run, some kind of auto concatenation plugin, basically anything for his, like, largely SAS-based development environment. And then use npm install to get those dependencies rolling. Two things bother Ed Bummings about this. One, sometimes I'm not in a place with an internet connection. Well, that's going to get you, isn't it? Two, some of these packages are a little large and they take a minute to download, which makes me wonder how much space my node_modules can be taking on my limited hard drive. Answer, probably a lot.
I'm
a true number and not hell.
Working on a project. The project's fine, but you know, npm install and it's just 1400 repos show up in my node modules folder. 1400, Chris. 14. That's a true number. I'm not lying.
Wow.
I'm like, how is it? This is like, like, I don't know, a toothpick castle.
Isn't the isolation feel a little good, though? And that, like, you npm install, everything's working, this project is good to go, that, like, you're not going to come back to it the next day, and because the global version changed, you did nothing at all in this project, something's broken now? Like, that's unacceptable. So it's kind of no wonder to me that these things are isolated from each other.
Yeah, well, and that's the thing, is, like, you, Ed, use like you use all these things, and wouldn't it be cool to just install them once? But like, not everyone is you, right? Like, so if somebody new shows up, how are they going to get the stuff? And it's better to have like the dev dependencies and the like actual deployment dependencies kind of all bundled together. I want to say, isn't there an NPM flag, like use local?
Is that there one? Yeah, I could see that. There's definitely like offline cache, especially in Yarn. Yarn's good at the caching thing.
Yeah, I feel like there was like a, for that use case where you like might be getting on an airplane or something, like
that was a good classic Davatron tweet, wasn't it? Like, about to get on an airplane, make sure you NPM install. NPM, I ruined the joke.
No, that, dude, that's, it's the worst, because if you try to NPM install on an airplane, the airplane will actually fall out of the sky. It takes up so...
It's literally the physical weight of the bytes that have arrived. On
Yeah, it's like
changes to aerodynamics.
Takes the airplane down. I'm not going to find it on this podcast, but I want to say there was like a clever way to like... It's not dash dash use local or something, but like it was something like that. There might be like a way to kind of say like, hey, check local first.
I'm telling you, because we're working on all this NPM stuff at CodePen, because we're rolling out a feature, hopefully not too super long from now, which is like a use stuff from NPM. And so when you
did,
I have to talk about it, because if it's not releasing now, we need to work harder or something. But no, it's pretty cool. It's like you know, and it has Algolia search, you know, because Algolia has a we figured it out. They somebody there did some work to make an Algolia indexable, searchable at all of NPM that's updated like every 10 seconds. So it's pretty cool. So you search and you type React and React DOM and whatever, and you pick these packages, and then we built a machine that will pull them and package them. And so we were kind of living that, like, well, we can't pull it every time, right? That's not very fast. Can't we have a local cache of React, because if it hasn't changed, so that it's wicked fast when somebody wants to build that package? And the answer is yes, totally, you can do that. So there is some story.
Well, there you go. All right, well, let's do one more, shall we? And then we'll wrap it up here. Josh Smith writes in, I'm getting really into this React thing. It's exciting, but I have a background of building websites with Mustache and WordPress, particularly PSD2 WordPress. To create a page with those, I'd create a static HTML, then sprinkle in some PHP or JS and call the appropriate templates. Now, with React, it looks like every single itty-bitty element of that static HTML would be built with a React component. It doesn't matter if that element will never change, thus being kind of static. In React, it is still a component, but basically a component that never changes, ! Intero bang. I think I might be operating in the paradigm that you can still build the page in static HTML for that one tiny little news ticker. You could use React. Is that correct? Tina Belcher, ladies.
Yeah.
Thank you, Tina, for stopping by the podcast.
Yes, you could have a page in static HTML and then instantiate React on a child element of that page and just use React on that child element. I don't see that paradigm, if you will, as Josh said, very common. React is more of an all-in, do the page in React situation.
Technically, a lot of Facebook actually works kind of like that. Like, there's just little pieces of React sitting in the big page. But more or less, you know, anytime, it's just like you code out a WordPress theme, you know, and instead of writing like a block of PHP in your partial, like your underscore file or whatever, like underscore something, now that's a React component, and you just wrap it in a render method and a bunch of React boilerplate stuff, and now you have a React component.
Well, it's just an awful lot of framework for one little widget, I'd say. And you've hamstrung yourself, because let's say you want to go SPA, well, you can't, because you're half and half. You got 1 foot in both worlds. What if you want to like do some React routing stuff? Well, you can't really because it's just too weird. I mean, I guess you kind of can, but you're in two router land and stuff. Let's say you want to do some server-side rendering. You're not probably going to have a good time with that because you're already server-side rendered except for one little React component that you need to like stitch server-side render and then stitch together with the other server-side rendering. That way complicates an already complicated story. I would say...
Can I interest you in some jQuery?
Yes, or like just, yeah, some you can make a React component that has static crap in it. Sure. Go for it.
I would probably recommend like Preact because it's way a bit bunch smaller. So that might, you know, kind of, you could get that flavor, very minimal payload and start kind of piecing in things. But like Chris says, like to do that, you're really only using about like 1/100th of the power of React. I feel like just when I think about what those things offer, that like the state management, the, you know, the component architecture, the, if you're using like React's big thing, I feel like is the component architecture. I don't like the all
what
in
are
JS,
people's but, story but, of static React components. Like, do people think about that? Is there some blog posts on how best to handle that world? Do you write it in the same way you would write a very state heavy component? I suppose you would. Why not? Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you maybe like get away from like a bunch of the component did mount, component will mount, you know, you don't have to do that. You don't even have to do
all you have is a render method. That's it.
Yeah. You don't even need a constructor, right?
I've even seen a markdown component where the render method is like a template literal of markdown. Why not?
Yeah. So, yeah. There you go. It just markdown, template literal, some code. So yeah, I would, you know, Josh, I think you're like, it's cool. You're playing with it. I think you should build stuff with it, but I think you're maybe, you know, you're bringing a bazooka to a gunfight at this point. So, it maybe like, it's not the right tool right now, but it's going to pay off. I mean,
I remember in the early days, that's how I thought of React. That's what I thought React was, oh, you can sprinkle in React. You do not need to go all in on it. The parrot, you know, the thing that everybody was parroting was React is not a framework. I think you'll find React is not a framework. And it was like, it's a framework.
Yeah. There was so much. Don't get me started. Okay. There's so much anti-marketing. It's like the DOM is slow. React, so good. Not a framework. It's just how you're going to build your whole damn site. Anyway, don't. Come on.
It was weird. The early days were weird of it. It definitely kind of, it had me intrigued and scared me off at the same time in the early days.
Yeah, I have I don't use React that much, but you know, they start React projects are coming across my desk more and more. So it's like something I probably need to do. But then I was writing a little game. Hopefully it releases soon, but I'm like kind of far enough into it and it has like just enough state video games are all state, right? It's just this like, okay, you're on level 2. Now this is different. This is how many enemies or whatever. I'm just like, oh man, I should probably write this in React. I mean, you know, like,
I mean, what's an alternative that's a state management tool only? I don't know that you're going to find one.
4,000 lines of jQuery.
MobX, I guess.
Vanilla. Yeah. I mean, there's, you know, Angular. I've been using Angular on some projects. I like Angular. It has like technically a 2-way data flow, but I think they've pared that down for a 1-way data flow, just like React. It's good. I like Angular. There is like another overhead. They've kind of went all in on TypeScript. So now you have, you have to kind of bundle that in.
I think and that's some of that syntax cool. It hurts us at CodePen. Cause I'm like, our TypeScript frankly sucks at CodePen and it's so complicated that I don't know how to handle it super well. But anyway, you're right.
I'm very interested like in static typing. I mean, I look at things like Unity, which I also like have been working with, You know, Unity is C sharp and it has JavaScript, but it's like strong type JavaScript. It's like a fake JavaScript. But the C sharp, you know, you're just like, you know, this is okay. This has a whatever, a health, and that's an integer. Like, it's never going to be anything else. You don't have to.
Yeah, but you have to code, you know, that it's an integer.
Right. Yeah, but you never have to coerce that it's an integer. You know, like, you never have to be like,
right.
If equals equals equals, you know, integer, you know, type of thing is integer or whatever. You never have to, like, it's determine cool. that, which you kind of.
Seems to me that even editors, though, are getting a little bit more IDE-like and starting to help with this without needing to pick a framework-y thing like Flow or TypeScript, that it can start looking at your code and being like, I think you mean that to be an integer, but I don't know. It's do you want to trust your IDE to do that for you, or do you want to just use a software that's designed to do it?
Yeah, no, there's a, in Visual Studio Code, there's a, like a, you can just at any, the top of any file, I think you can like do like
your types,
check TS or TypeScript, check TypeScript, check. I wish I knew what it was. I can't even Google for it, but it's like, you can just.
It's funny that our whole industry is like, yeah, type checking, that's a good idea.
Yeah. And then, then it's like, but we're not going to do it. So, but no, I wish I had it here. But there's like a one liner. You can just like add a comment to the top of your like JavaScript file and it'll code will like run TypeScript against it because it, like code is all written in
JavaScript. It's your prop types for all JavaScript instead of just your React components.
Yeah.
Does Vue have prop types? I don't know. Does Angular? Like, I expect this data to be in these types. This is a function and it's required. This is a string and it's not required.
Yeah, there's some, like you basically kind of do that at the like constructor definition-y sort of level. Yeah.
That's all. We don't need to get into it.
Hey.
We're fading fast.
Yeah. All right. Hey, thank you, dear listener, for downloading this in your podcast of choice. Be sure to star heart, favorite it up. That's how people find out about the show. Follow us on Twitter at Shop Talk Show for tens of tweets a month. And if you hate your job, head over to shoptalkshow.com/jobs and get a brand new one because people want to hire people like you, even if, probably if you've been working 5 months or learning for 5 months. You can do it. You got it. Just try. And Chris, you got anything else you'd like to say?
Thanks again, everybody who wrote in about our thing and choptalkshow.com.